Hello, and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and if you're tuning in online and having technical issues, remember that you can listen to the show by calling in via your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. That's 657-383-0525. And to those of you who are listening live and are in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com, welcome and thank you so much for tuning in. This is our 14th episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting live at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, on this April 11, 2015. In this episode, we travel to the British Isles to discuss English magical traditions with noted historian, poet, and necromancer Al Cummins, who himself hails from the United Kingdom, but has graciously been gracing us with his gentlemanly presence here in the United States. Today is a call-in show. So if you have any questions, thoughts, or comments on the topic, please do call in to 657-383-0525. And remember to dial 1 so that I know that you're in the queue, as we both love to have you on. As we do every episode, we'll be beginning with a poem from the book Earth Prayers, 365 Prayers, Poems, and Invocations from Around the World. This poem comes to us via Hildegard of Bingen. I am the one whose praise echoes on high. I adorn all the earth. I am the breeze that nurtures all things green. I encourage blossoms to flourish with ripening fruits. I am led by the Spirit to feed the purest streams. I am the rain coming from the dew. It causes the grasses to laugh with the joy of life. I am the yearning for good. And without much ado, I would like to simply have Al Cummins right on. And we have so much to talk about. Al is also a very good friend of mine, and his work is just phenomenal. As a writer, as a historian, as a poet, and one of the most awesome things that we have on the show today as well is as a musical collaborator. So that's going to be showing up a little bit later on the show. Al, are you there?
I am indeed. Hello, Kai.
Thank you so much for joining me on the show today. One of the best parts for me living in New York at this time in my life right now is knowing that you are just a couple of subway stops away, to be completely honest with you, just a couple of stops away to be able to hang out with you and talk about magic and talk about tradition and compare notes, about these traditions from around the world. You just complete, in addition to many of your publications, you've been published by, your work can be found in publications by Haitian Press, such as the Conjure Codex. I know that you have work that's coming up right now regarding magical talismans and some of your studies regarding that. Let's see what else we have going on here. You're up in a piece that's being published by Oxford, Heaven and Earth Was, Is, and Shall Be Shaken, Millenarianisms of 2012 in the 17th Century, in the Enduring Problems with Prophecy, which is sort of one of my favorite topics, looking at prophecy throughout history and some of how that doesn't always, fit together, but we have a lot about culture and society when we're looking at millenarianisms. But let's start with, because we can start anywhere, but let's start with one of your biggest accomplishments, which was just having completed your studies at the University of Bristol.
Yes, just finishing up my doctorate. Until you are officially given the handshake by the relevant authorities at the university, who themselves were given that handshake as a sort of academic initiation. I'm not technically a doctor yet, but I can refer to myself as a doctor-elect. British universities, as you may be aware, are infamous for having a variety of, shall we say, old traditions, some of which are somewhat odd. But yes, I just finished my doctoral thesis on magic and the emotions or the passions in early modern England, which is period.
Which is a theory.
Well, I say early modern. That's a term generally meaning somewhere between 1500s and 1700. Some people push that further into the 18th century. Others push back further to the Renaissance. But it's a period that I'm very interested in, especially 17th century England, because it was a tumultuous time for many reasons that I'd love to talk to you about. But also because it's kind of a bridge between then and now. 17th century England particularly interests me, partly because on the one hand it's relatively modern. You know, things like that we might take for granted now. You know, there were bars at this point. There were places you could go and see a gig. That, you know, toothbrushes were invented around that time, these kinds of like modernity things. But on the other hand, there was also a firm belief in astrology, in witchcraft. Obviously, the witch trials and the witch hunts were around this period of early modern Europe. And so it really feels to me like a bridge between where we find ourselves today and our ancestors.
For those of you who are in the chat room, a tremendous amount of links regarding the work of Al Cummins are being posted. So definitely, you know, if you usually listen to the show archived, definitely find the time to join us in the chat room, because of the resources that we can't, you know, just discuss. I absolutely cannot list all of Mr. Cummins' accolades, but Nagashiba is doing a really great job in the chat room. Stalking his internet presence and providing us with great resources. This is really interesting, this idea that in the 17th century England, we find a sort of you find a unique bridge to modern times in terms of the beliefs of the time and the sort of modern inventions that we are now, you know, obviously depending on. I depended on a toothbrush this morning. But in the broad range of your studies and the work that you've been doing, is there anything personal that really brought you to want to focus on this time period and this subject matter, magic and the emotions, for the length of, you know, your doctorate? That's a huge project.
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I came to doing this doctorate through my master's, which was also by research, and that was on the functions of astrology in this period. It's an incredibly important time. The 17th century has several civil wars. A king is killed. You may have heard of this. The plague, famine. It's not a great time by many accounts. But the other things that are happening there are the during the English Revolution, there's an explosion of occult publishing. It's said that the English learned to read partly from the Vulgate Bible published at this time, but also from almanacs containing astrological information ranging from prophecies about, you know, the political sphere to advice on medicine, when to gild your lambs, when to plant your crops. And these ranged from, you know, very rule of thumb moon law to, you know, incredibly complicated computational astrology. And one of the things that interested me in looking at astrology was the social functions it provided. If you were ill in 17th century England, you had a couple of choices of the kind of medical practitioner you could go to. The Royal College of Physicians would move into your house for thousands of pounds a day to look after you. This was not an option available to very many people. On the other hand, there are a wide variety of irregular medical practitioners, as they're usually called by historians, and these ranged from the apothecary grocers to charmers, you know, the seventh son of the seventh son, who, you know, might be regarded as kind of magical medical specialists who could charm warts, these kinds of things. The cunning folk, more broadly speaking, you know, your village wise woman. And also a variety of astrologer physicians and magicians who sort of, again, bridge this kind of divide that sometimes emerges in the studies of this kind of thing between folk magic and more high ceremonial, in inverted commas, kinds of practices. And really what I was interested in was the healing dimensions of this, that magic is talked about in terms of providing us, hopefully, with a spiritual path that can, you know, give us better reflection on our interrelation with each other, with spirits, with the land, and with our dead. And so I was interested in the role that magic could play in attempting to map and manage and even manipulate the passions of oneself and others. And so that's really what led me to the doctoral study.
I find it so interesting that one of the things you mentioned is that during this time there is an increase or even just a beginning of the printing of occult pamphlets. At least a dissemination of occult pamphlets of all kinds. And the first thing that brings to mind is I'm always interested in the connection between practices that are of the people, sort of, as you mentioned, cunning folk practices, and that's really where I want to go here, cunning folk practices that are practicing, most likely often without books, sort of just based on oral history, information that's been given to them by others. And what is do you see a connection at all between, or what's the connection that you've seen between the cunning folk practices that were being practiced, say, before the 16th, 17th century, and the dissemination of these kinds of occult books, and what relationship, what effect that those had on those practices?
Well, one of the things that a couple of historians of magic and early modernist historians have pointed out is that this period marks a considerable democratization of magic, as it gets called sometimes. A lot of texts, things like the various Keys of Solomon, were being circulated in manuscript form. The same can be said for the monumental encyclopedia of occult philosophy by Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa, the three books of occult philosophy, which is published in the mid-16th century, but it achieves an English translation in the 1650s. So these texts were kind of available to a few people if you knew someone who knew someone. But one of the things that's exciting about this occult publication boom is the works of people like Robert Turner in translating a variety of texts from Paracelsus, who's giving us new medical models as well as various alchemical practices, and also a variety of new botanies and new what gets called kitchen physic. And this is physic as the root of physician. This is teaching people doctoring from their home and with the herbs and plants and animals that are around them. You know, there are plenty of occult texts that say, you know, take the blood of a phoenix and the feather of a unicorn or whatever. But there was a big movement to democratize not just ceremonial magic, but also herbal magic, also the working with plants. And we see this in a variety of settings, from the cunning folk to astrologer physicians to even grimoire magicians were using these kinds of plant allies and expressly considering them as plant allies. I'm happy to talk about a couple of specific examples from a working magical book that we have attributed to a practitioner called Arthur Gauntlet, who talks about using specific tricks and deployments of valerian, vervain, and yarrow, which also crop up in many other magical traditions. And there's some similar overlap of those kinds of uses that the collaboration between magician and plant provide.
Love this. This is almost, the idea of magical privilege, this idea of different stratas of society and their access to magical information, to different kinds of magical information. And just that term that I think was so perfect as to what I was sort of getting at, the a change in the democratization of magic.
Yeah.
This time.
That's well, one of the first, what gets called an English language grimoire is I think an interesting case. It's the publication of a book called The Discovery of Witchcraft by Reginald Scott, and the first edition comes out in 1584. And the object that that young Reginald had with the book was to demonstrate that witchcraft was a superstitious nonsense, that it was the delusions of old women and gullible people who would believe this thing. Now, this wasn't a terribly popular view in Scott's own time, but what makes the book particularly interesting is that he is cataloguing in excruciating detail at some points the very rituals that he's claiming are superstitious and A, don't work, and B, are, even if they did work, would be diabolic and not things that you should be practicing. As a lot of the time, he's using this as a means to decry Catholicism. Obviously, the early modern period is also when England splits from Rome, with Henry VIII wanting to, you know, bear a son by being able to divorce his queens. Reginald Scott then publishes this work saying, you know, don't do magic. It doesn't work and it's wrong. And here are exactly the kinds of spells that you shouldn't be doing. And we have categorical evidence of cunning folk right the way across England of using this book to make the talismans that he's listing. You know, there is no such thing as bad news to an extent, or bad news travels faster. This notion that one of the first English language grimoires is produced as a means to decry it, but becomes incredibly popular with the very people that want to use it for its purposes, fascinates me. And again, it's back to that idea of democratization and access to things. And some of these wards, they're, you know, talismans against thieves. They're cropping up in forms. You know, they're hidden in barns in very folk magic ways, but they're also cropping up in a variety of ceremonial magics as well. Many of them are concerned with the spirits paying you homage. You know, you have to wear a certain laman to be recognized as having some kind of authority over the spirits. And so that we're seeing the contagion, if you like, of these kinds of occult ideas and magical practices percolating through an awful lot of different strata of society.
I simply love what you're talking about, how a book that would, you know, that sort of saying, don't do this, this is ridiculous, people say, ah, thank you for providing this information.
Yeah. Yes, I feel there's something quite English about that.
But it also reminds me of a sort of a human... An aspect of human society that which we suppress automatically in that suppression becomes that much more magnified.
Yes.
Some of the work of theorist Judith Butler does that, looking at some of the American laws in the 1990s that were used to suppress discussion of, say, sexuality in American army, and how all that did was just, you know, unlock all the doors, and that was sort of the only thing anyone could ever think about or talk about. So I love that that's a constant conversation that we come across in human society. That which is suppressed and repressed just becomes magnified and all the more on the table, which is also, you know, related to, you know, the idea of contagion. We've used the word grimoire a lot, and I would love if you very graciously and generously said that you would be willing to tell us a bit about a plant working from a grimoire. But I'd love to start with, for our listeners, just a general idea of what a grimoire is. I know that, you know, there's lots of ideas. Anyone who touches a grimoire will come across so many different terms and titles. And, you know, is a grimoire an empty book that's pretty that I buy on Etsy? Love to, if you could sort of give, what's your definition of a grimoire?
Well, the simplest definition would just be to say a magical book of some kind. Now, these could range from what I refer to as working books, which are more like the notebooks of a practicing magician. They contain, you know, lists of, you know, the correspondences of the planets to particular incenses that you would use in planetary ritual. These kinds of reference type books. There's also the notion of a grimoire as a book that teaches a particular magical system and that might have a particular roster of spirits attached to it. And there are usually several components of these kinds of magical books. There will be a spirit list, which will contain the names, sometimes the seals, and sometimes what's referred to as the offices, the kind of powers of the spirit, what they can do. A second component of these kinds of grimoires that are teaching a particular magical system will be the means of making the tools in order to summon spirits, which is really the core of grimoires. They're manuals of conjuration, and you'll be taught how to make the tools at particular astrological times and processes that you might be involved in, like burying them in a graveyard for a particular amount of time or over a moon cycle. Then there will also be the conjurations themselves, which most grimoires drew from medieval exorcism manuals. The notion was that if you could tell a spirit to leave, you could also exercise various other forms of authority over the spirit. And finally, there are appended sections to many grimoires referred to as things like the books of secrets. And these are the closest thing to a particular spell. So whereas the rest of the grimoire might be referred to as a means to build the phone, if you like, to talk to the spirit, the phone book of the number to call to get hold of that spirit, they won't necessarily say what you do when you have that spirit there. There'll be the conjurations of how to get it up and get it to do what you want. But the books of secrets contain things more like, you know, draw the seal of this spirit in the footprint of the person you wish to bewitch in some way. That's an example pulled out of the air. The final instance of what can be referred to as grimoires are what is generally referred to as a liber spiritum, or a book of spirits. And this is very much more a kind of process. It's if you like, halfway between the working book, where you're just, you know, writing down spells as you find them in other books and keeping them on hand for reference, and the grimoires that we're teaching a particular magical system. If you like, a liber spiritum is something like how you channel and create your own system, collaborating with spirits who will tutor and empower you in that practice. And that's kind of where I think, you know, a lot of later Wiccan ideas about a book of shadows emerges from, this notion that one would do a variety of divination and channeling and scrying, and that these spirit tutors would help one formulate one's own system. And these liber spiritums are themselves talismanic. They're not just books about magic. They are magical objects in of themselves. And so there are various instructions in a variety of works of occult philosophy on how to make one of these things. It generally involves having the seal of a spirit on one page and the description and the conjuration of it on the other. And so it's kind of a little black book of spirits that you can call up yourself. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. Even for myself, you've given me such a better perspective on what a grimoire is. Now, in the 21st century, how many, if this is even possible, this might be a ridiculous question, but how many European grimoires of ancient times do we have access to? How many have arrived to us at this time for us in the modern age?
Well, the study of how texts come from older times come to be interpreted in later times is referred to in intellectual history as reception. So we talk about the reception of a particular text, say, you know, the poems of Ovid, how they were received in the Victorian period. And the reception of grimoires and magical books is difficult because these things were very often, you know, they weren't exactly approved of practices by the church, by various political authorities. If you have a lot of books teaching you how to assassinate people at a distance, which some of these grimoires did, then, you know, this is obviously not information that you want broadly circulated. So we have problems with the way in which we interpret what it means that a grimoire is complete. That's the other thing. It's easier. Many historians of magical books talk about families of texts, and these are their own kind of subgenres. So rather than talking about the Lesser Key of Solomon, we instead talk about a variety of manuscripts that are all kind of like the key, that contain, you know, specific elements of them. And this is partly due to the fact that the distribution of these grimoires was mainly done copying them out by hand. There were some printed grimoires as well. Happy to talk about those examples. Again, another reason why I love the 17th century. But on the whole, we have a couple. We have the what are broadly called the Solomonic texts, and these range from things like the Clavicula Salomonis, the Key of Solomon, to what's called the Greater Key, which contains far more of the means to make tools, and also contains the Pentacles of Solomon, which are used in a variety of magical practices. These are talismanic seals that are used to do various planetary magics. The set of grimoires I'm most interested in are the ones that kind of emerge from the Bibliothèque Bleue period in France around the 18th century. And they are expressly diabolical, and they concern various infernal hierarchies that one engages with in a variety of ways. And they share many of the features of the other grimoires, that they are concerned with commanding spirits through the names of God. But they also contain crucial elements of making pacts with spirits. And this fascinates me, particularly the notion that an agreement is reached, not one where one sells one's soul, but one where one collaborates with another powerful and respected figure, in this case, a spirit. And there's been some brilliant work on this kind of thing. I'm thinking particularly of Kunjuman Ali's piece in Scarlet Imprints, At the Crossroads, which discusses this kind of conjuration of spirits as a form of initiation, which I think is fascinating and definitely needs more people looking at this and exploring it.
Absolutely. You know, coming from a context that's rooted more in the African American practices of conjure in the rural South, mm-hmm. And seeing how the idea of someone making a pact with the black man at the crossroads, also is something that I totally get that idea of this being an initiatory moment in someone's life, this being an initiatory experience of making a pact, of the impact that a pact with another entity can have on one's life and achieve the means of that, because it's always through some kind of trial. It's always through some kind of thing that needs to be done. That's not just, I said these three words. You know, there's often some kind of proof. Some kind of proof of worthiness, or some kind of proof of trial being made that really ensures that pact can go through. You mentioned the willingness to share with us a plant working from one of the grimoires, and I wanted to first go to one of our great audio clips that we have for today before we get to that, if that's okay with you.
Of course.
Awesome. Thank you again so much for being here, and we will be right back on Sacred Ground.
It was upon a Lammas night when corn rigs are bonny, beneath the moon's unclouded light, I held a while to Annie. The time went by with careless heed till tween the late and early. With small persuasion she agreed to see me through the barley. Corn rigs and barley rigs, and corn rigs are bonny. I'll not forget that happy night among the rigs with Annie. Goodwill among the heart was all my own. I loved her most sincerely. I kissed her o'er and o'er again among the rigs of barley. Corn rigs and barley rigs and corn rigs are bonny. I'll not forget that happy night among the rigs with
On Sacred Ground. I'm the host, Kai Armand, and we are here with, as Nagashiva put in the chat room, Bristol-based historian, occultist, and octopus enthusiast, Al Cummings, who is so generously providing us with really incredible information for bringing European and English magical practices into context. And I'm just feeling so blessed and enriched by this conversation right now. And in our last segment, we were talking about grimoires and what they are and the reception of them to us who are alive in the early 21st century. And we were also being told that we were going to be provided with some information regarding a plant working from a grimoire. But before we get to that, we're going to be segueing into that conversation by going back to Mr. Cummins's recent doctoral thesis on magical practices in England as they relate to the passions and emotions of the individual. Mr. Cummins, would you be willing to speak on that more?
Of course, of course. So, as I said, I was very interested in how magic in the early modern period was being used for people to understand what it meant to feel particular emotions and to express them. And the occult philosophy and the magical practices based around mapping those more specifically and managing or moderating them, and also, exacerbating them in some kinds of, you know, love magic or curse work. So what I found was that there is actually a field of history that's concerned with emotion history. And a thing that two researchers, Peter and Carol Stearns, call emotionology. And this is the study of how emotions are, how emotional experience and expression is kind of curated, if you like, by a culture, how particular cultures teach people to grieve or to be angry or to be in love. What are the ways in which we do these things? And this comes across in a variety of ways in the 17th century where, you know, The difficulty of this study, on the one hand, is, you know, it's hard enough to know what's happening in, you know, in historical people's heads, let alone what's happening in their hearts. We have, we have accounts of, we have correspondence between people, love letters that sound, you know, wonderful and you know, probably are very genuine. But then we also see that large parts of those love letters are cribbed from manuals called things like How to Write Love Letters. And so this tension is there between what historical people felt and how it was recorded and how we receive it. And it's here that I think the study of magic is really helpful, because people were doing divination for themselves on how they felt, on their relations with their partners, with their colleagues, with fellow practitioners. And it's these records these charts, which are mainly astrological, but there's also some geomantic charts as well, that are particularly fascinating to me. One of the main things about looking at the emotions and magic in 17th century Europe and England specifically is that we need to understand that how we talk about emotions is not necessarily how people of the past would talk about emotions. The term that comes up far more often is passion. And a passion is different to an emotion in several ways. An historian of emotion, Thomas Dixon, says that, you know, roughly around the turn of the 18th century, we began talking about emotions as much more cognitive, as much more about what happens, you know, in your body as distinct from your mind, or what happens in your mind as distinct from your body. And this is generally pinned on the philosopher René Descartes, who, amongst other things, was very important in his mechanistic philosophy of separating mind and body. Now, this, as we've talked about very often, Kai, is a complex of issues to be pulled apart. But to thumbnail it, you know, in very brief précis, one of the things about the passions is that they are concerned with emotionality and expression of a ensouled mind-body complex. That's a kind of a fancy, awkward way of putting that the early modern subject or self, you know, wasn't concerned with, you know, oh, is this happening in my head, or is this, you know, reaction happening in my body, that these were considered at the very least interrelational. So looking at these passions, the thing I found mainly was that people were using divination to map them. And they were using astrological techniques. And they were also mapping their own passions, and they were also mapping the passions of their clients. And this occurs frequently as well. Astrologer physicians were some of the first medical practitioners in Europe to keep detailed case notes because, you know, as the stars shifted, as the illness or the emotional distress continued or exacerbated or declined, then you could have something to refer back to. And these detailed case notes are, in many cases, still with us. The historian Lauren Cassell has done an amazing job of putting these up online. The database called Magic and Medicine, based out of the University of Cambridge, is a searchable database from, I think, 1597 to the 1600s of two astrologer physician practitioners, Richard Napier and Simon Forman, who are astrologer physicians and practitioners who are offering their services as consultants, as doctors, for a variety of conditions, from anything from, you know, the kind of divination questions that many root workers will be familiar with, you know, does he love me back? Is she faithful? You know, is the baby mine? These kinds of questions they were answering, which obviously included a variety of, you know, a big passional or emotional component to them. And from there, one could talk about how these charts were used to affect solutions as well. You know, it wasn't just telling someone what was wrong with them. It was also about, you know, knowing how to rebalance their emotional well-being, if you like. And this is one of the key concepts in the history of European medicine anyway, is the notion of equilibrium. And this is based in the body of ideas that gets called Galenism. These are medical notions about the body and the mind and the soul. And these are based on the four humours, which you may be familiar with, which are ancient Greek and attributed to the four elements. And the notion was that good health, whether that was emotional or physical or spiritual, was based on the proper maintenance of the equilibrium of the balance of these four humours in the body. And so if you know that someone is overly choleric, is fiery, is hot-tempered, the language remains with these figurative and literal expressions, you know, that we talk about being cold-hearted or big-hearted. These are all, you know, concepts that were considered literal. If you know someone is choleric, then you can, you know, you haven't just diagnosed what's wrong with them. You've also come up with a solution, something that will potentially ameliorate that situation by, you know, offering them things that will cool them down, offering them, you know, the moisture of water where they're too dry, offering them something cold when they're too hot. And so we have this notion of rebalancing people's humours in order to better equilibrate their passions. And finally, we have all the fun stuff of love magic and the evil eye and fascination, and casting your passions or humours at other people, whether consciously or unconsciously. And thus, here we're back to notions of contagion.
Before we get to the passions, before we get to the love magic, I would love to just sort of make sure I have this right in my own head. So, and I think that the humors analogy is really perfect, because I know that when I went to school, I was, you know, we were being taught that early European, well, not very, very early, but some centuries back, you know, basic, you know, biology, medical practices were seen as different because the body was seen as different. What was crucial to the well-being of the body was seen as different. And the four humors and understanding of that was sort of the basis of that of medical practice at that time. So what you're saying, if we're going to look at that regarding the body, we also have to look at the ways in which the mind-emotion connection was seen as different.
Yeah, yeah. The humours are not the same as the passions, but particular humours had passions that were more associated with them. Okay?
Okay, yeah, yeah. And out of this, because people did not understand or see the mind-emotion connection the same way as we see them now, it's a little bit unique for
yeah,
us to sort of...
Yeah. Yeah, one of the there's a historian, Bruce Green, who says that the trouble with Descartes and his separating the mind from the body is that he says Descartes convinced European thinkers of the time and some to this day that they could think without their bodies. And one of the reasons I'm interested in looking at the 17th century on a sort of prior to the Enlightenment, which, you know, did an awful lot of good in preventing, you know, the religious wars that had raged for hundreds of years across Europe. It also, you know, has been argued to have thrown some babies out with that bathwater. And one of the things that I'm interested in is how an holistic approach to mind, body and soul was worked by these kinds of cunning folk and astrologer physicians.
Well, that makes so much sense because, you know, in the context, obviously, at least for me when I was in school, the idea of humors and, you know, it was just presented as, ha, 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 you know, so laughable that we were so wrong ago. But in this conversation, I'm thinking, oh, no, that makes sense. If one is, you know, obviously so much of indigenous practices that we find around the world, from, you know, from shamanism, neo-shamanism to Taoist practices, we find that, you know, about the need for rebalancing.
I can guarantee that a lecture I will give, which will involve talking about humoral theory, I'll always get someone who comes up to me at the end and says, "You really need to be looking at the comparisons with traditional Chinese medicine with this stuff," you know, again, is about rebalancing. You know, the same, the human enmattered versions of these cosmic elemental forces that make up the universe.
Absolutely.
Well, I was just going to say that partly what that, the importance of that is that you are, you know, the elements and the humors by extension were a way of looking qualitatively rather than quantitatively at the universe. Okay, so when we talk about the elemental composition of something, we're talking about, you know, everything being compounded from these four elements, but we find corollaries and analogs and ways of describing the experiential quality of a thing rather than the measurements of it, rather than its quantitative, you know, how much does that, you know, how much does it weigh, you know, what numbers can we attach to it? So, you know, illness, emotional states, natural phenomena were all conceived of in this manner of elemental thinking, whereby, you know, something was, you know, speedy like the air, and contained water, and, you know, seemed to be very tempestuous like fire, and was black like the earth, and we can say a storm cloud, right? This is a poetic way of interacting with the world and with natural philosophy and natural history. Okay, this isn't backwards or primitive. You know, it's not inferior to a way of doing measurement. It does different things.
Thank you so much for recontextualizing so much of what I think we so many of us have been taught and told about medicinal practices and having us to leading us to understand those in a different way. So if we're talking about emotions as you know as passions in sort of a, in a larger context of the mind body emotional space, then obviously we're about manipulation of those things in a different way, leading us directly to this idea of, so then what effect does that have on ancient or 17th century ideas of love magic and manipulating the passions of others and ourselves?
Well, there are a couple of things. One is, again, a contagion model, which is basically that an expression to literally express something, right? So in vehement passions, which were you know, very worried about, there was a notion in Europe that referred to as psychomachia, the war of the soul. And this was the idea that the good, you know, righteous, pious Christian should, you know, exalt the rational parts of the faculties of their soul in order to repress the animalistic urges. And these vehement passions were considered dangerous because they could spill out of the porous self of the subject experiencing them. So, you know, if you were furious, then you would be steaming, right? Your blood would boil, and these things might reach out of your body in this contagious manner and affect other people and make them angry or afraid of your anger. And this is a route that's used to explain various aspects of witchcraft, which was debated over the period. It's important to bear in mind that there wasn't one solid position on really any of these things. But it's also the way in which love was sometimes talked about. And the thing with love magic is we need to understand how love was conceived to some degree. And there's a root tension in love, which I think, or in the early modern notions of love, which I think gives us some wider inkling into the approach to the passions as well, which is that on the one hand, love makes us crazy, right? Love is, you know, it can be referred to as a sickness or a pathology, like many of these vehement passions were, you know, something that causes us imbalance and suffering and makes us so uncertain and potentially slaves to our impulses, which, you know, at the time these people were very worried about. But on the other hand, love is also ennobling. It brings out the best of us. It is, you know, us emulating our loving creator, and in that reflection, a mysticism forming. It is something that brings us together in a commonwealth of blood and of bone and of this, you know, living family tree. You know, and it's expressly conceived of in these notions by occult philosophers like Marsilio Ficino, that love is a form of sympathy, and this is meant in the strictest term of the magical principle of sympathy and antipathy, that things go together and other things go apart in a very crude way of explaining it. This is something, one of the ways Agrippa talks about magic itself, that magic is the agreement and disagreement of things and the knowing of how to use that. So in understanding love as ennobling on the one hand and kind of you know, a pathology, you know, potential for a disease or an affliction, we can start to conceive of what love sickness was like. And love sickness could take the form of a fixation upon your apparent beloved, of thinking about them constantly. And this was particularly important in the early modern period because there were wider conversations going on about psychology. Both psychology and psychiatry are early modern French terms initially, I believe. And the notion of what the imagination is doing when it makes images of things and when you fixate upon them was very worrisome, particularly to English theorists. You know, the reason, logic, you know, has to follow logically, hence the term, whereas the imagination is creative, and that creativity is potentially very scary. This is the root of a lot of Puritan iconoclasm, that, you know, we don't want icons of things, we don't want images of things because they carry power. And if you can make those images in your head or your heart, then you are potentially powerful and to be both, you know, feared and regulated, but also praised if that works, you know, done towards the benefit of, you know, understanding one's loving creator better, and in hopefully being a better person and a more loving person.
Example of a love magic working from a grimoire during this time period that you could provide.
I can give you a couple of specific ones. The more basic tendency is that the long tradition of love magic, you know, of inducing love in someone else, is mainly dealing more with the Ovidian sense, the sense in Ovid and other poets, that love is this kind of affliction, and that you afflict love, the arrows of Cupid, you know, where the bolt of Cupid fell, as Shakespeare puts it. So the key components of this were usually reverse engineering love from its symptoms. So what are people who are in love like? Well, they burn very hot, they burn with a passion. So you attempt to inflict, you know, a burning in them in some way, you make an image of them and heat it up. Otherwise, forms of subjugation of the target of your love spell, that you dominate them in some way. And this is done in a couple of spells from various grimoires, where you would form an image of the person that you wanted to enchant on paper, and you'd name it. You'd name a piece of paper cut out as you. You'd place that on top, and then you'd place the two in your shoe, and you'd walk on them. And you do this in the hour of Venus and various other bits and pieces towards gathering the virtues of Venus to direct at someone. Other examples of love magic, particularly interesting, I think, in terms of both text and the land, are apples. The grimoire I mentioned, Arthur Gauntlet, has 18 different love apple spells, all of them involving writing on the apple in some way, and then getting the person that you want to enchant to eat it. And these range wildly from very simple things written on them, sequences of letters that look like what sometimes get called barbarous names, to actually calling spirits to empower the love apple before you eat it. And again, in being interested in the demonology of this kind of thing, occasionally it is explicitly meant, you know, it is explicitly done in ritual, that one calls this apple the apple that, you know, the serpent tempted Eve with. So we have this notion of some of the core Christian myths and religious tenets being utilized in a very operative way, and not necessarily for what would be called pious Christian ends.
Absolutely. And you mentioned Venusian influences in magic. Mm-hmm. I believe I mentioned earlier that you're an astrologer. In the context of astrology and planetary influences, we have a piece, actually an artistic piece, that you did with the UK-based band Tomorrow We Sail, that, if I understand correctly, is an invocation of the planet Saturn.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I took a variety of texts, some much older things like the Arabic Picatrix, which is an old manual of Arabic astrological magic, some stuff from Sefer Raziel, an old Jewish text of magic, and some from a book by the 17th century England's most famous astrologer, William Lilly, who produced this incredibly popular handbook, Christian Astrology. And I took various pieces of the text from those and formed an invocation by cut up, if you like, or collage, which itself is a thing that, you know, happens across history anyway. And we produced a piece of music that was designed to invoke Saturn as the ruler of melancholy and of sorrow, in order to write it and to dignify those sufferings for anyone that heard it. Was the notion.
It's a truly beautiful piece that I'm so grateful we were able to have available for this episode. And we're going to go over to that right now. And I look forward to, after that, continuing this wonderful conversation. Again, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Kai.
second, Miroel. The third, Kayim. The fourth, Hakia. The fifth, Sauron. The sixth, Sithia. The seventh, Nach.
Listening to another fine production of the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hooter Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. This is the longest-running conjure show on the planet and may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner. Starring Candelo Cambisa and Malik Cambisa, this is the voice of authentic Cuban Palo and Dominican Sanse in the United States, with special guests representing the entire range of African traditional and diasporic religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Tuesdays, a pair of outstanding hosts point the way to essential values. First, on the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance in the practical use of crystals and crystal balls for the development of mental concentration, mind power, divination, and telepathic communication. His show airs Tuesday evenings from 5 to 6 o'clock Pacific Time. Once you have your bearings, engage in activism and social justice in the streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly brings listeners front-page reports on the ongoing struggle for racial, gender, and social justice, shedding much light on civil and social rights issues. Her cry for freedom begins at 6 p.m. Pacific Time and inspires us for 1 hour. On Wednesdays, Andrea Weston's Liquid Libations pour forth to bless us with poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances. If you are a poet or someone who simply enjoys the beauty and power of words, then Liquid Libations welcomes your participation. Call in and read your work. Listen for Liquid Libations on Wednesdays from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, from deep in the heart of Texas, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the silver-tongued professor shares his knowledge of roots and delivers the lucky numbers. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern. Tax and license may apply. Train departure times and Burmeshave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person to see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual. We're back on Sacred Ground. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and today we have special guest Mr. Al Cummins, hailing from the UK by way of the United States these days, gratefully, in just a few subway stops away from me, right in Brooklyn. who is a truly notable historian, poet, musical collaborator, and necromancer. And before we get to the rest of our excellent, incredible discussion on passions and humors in 17th century England and magic for love and for manipulating and regulating these passions. There's a question coming from the chat room regarding what, from your studies, Mr. Cummins, has come into your own modern, how has this been reflected in your own modern practice?
Right. Well, there's a couple of things I could talk about. I mean, the actual ways in which the passions are moderated come down very often to practical things that we find in a variety of modern folk magic traditions, the use of particular herbs as well as amulets, but also even more basic things like sociability. You know, if you are miserable, it's not always the best idea to hang out with other miserable people. Now, you know, obviously we all have our bad days, and it's important to, you know, have some solidarity with your friends and your kin. But these are, you know, basic kind of things that can be to do with how to ensure one doesn't overreach when one is, you know, feeling fragile. You know, a good example might be like, it's not always the best idea if you are feeling, you know, pessimistic or melancholy to watch many, you know, mainstream news programs, for instance. That isn't to say that, you know, it isn't vitally important to stay informed, but sometimes staying informed doesn't necessarily involve particular major news networks. I hope I'm not becoming too political in that kind of notion.
So this is the show for being political, unfortunately.
I thought so. The other issue is that I'm very invested in practicing from the grimoires. I can talk about my favourite grimoire. It's the Grimoireum Verum. And it's one of those grimoires that's very much based around making pacts with spirits and respectfully working with them via their own hierarchies rather than threatening them with the names of spirits. I am cautious about reflecting too much of my own practice, partly because one of the things that emerges from looking at the traditions of necromancy and grimoire work is that certain taboos around secrecy aren't merely a matter of ensuring that you weren't arrested for doing bad things, but were themselves part of the working. You know, we may well be familiar with the concept of going to the crossroads in silence and doing something and coming back in silence and not looking back behind you. One of the instances I can definitely give you is of a particular grimoire from the 1560s. Which contained in a volume of manuscripts kept by the additional library in the UK, and it's a unique grimoire. It's referred to as the Excellent Book of the Art of Magic. You know, not all of these practitioners were terribly humble, but it's unique because it also contains the scrying records, referred to simply as the visions of the magician and scryer who were conjuring spirits in order for the spirits to tell them how to write a grimoire in order to learn the secrets of the universe and to practice magic. And so we have, normally we get one or the other. We get the scrying records of John Dee and Edward Kelly, arguably two of the most famous early modern magical practitioners. Or we get the system that they channeled, if you like. We get the particular grimoires as a particular magical system. What's unique about the Excellent Book is that we have both. So we have not only the injunction to wear black, which the spirits command these two to do, we also have the vision. So we don't just have the instruction in the grimoire, you know, in a set of instructions. We also have the reason why they did that. And in the case of Humphrey Gilbert and John Davies, who were the magician and scryer working these books, it was the appearance of spirits such as King Solomon, Adam, Job, various evangelists, various older dead magicians, and realizing that this particular source represented a specifically necromantic tradition in early modern English magic has been instrumental in my own practice. I can say that. One of the features of this secrecy is also, I think, a kind of humility, I hope, that the spirits, this grimoire holds the record, that the spirit of Solomon appears and tells them, you can summon these other dead magicians, but you can't tell anyone that you've done it. And this, to me, feels, as I say, almost a little bit like a humility thing. You know, it feels a little bit like the point that I feel people sometimes miss in talking about past lives, where they might have convinced themselves that they were, you know, someone very important in a past life, and that this means that we should then have to listen to them in this life. You know, from my perspective, I think that if you've found that connection or that you know, that source of empowerment and spiritual fulfillment, that should inspire you to do more work now. You know, I think it's important that people don't rest on their laurels or, you know, hide behind the skirts of a famous historical figure. You know, if, for example, I were to say, purely hypothetically, that I would, you know, summon the spirit of a ghost of a dead magician of this period, talk to them, ask them for pointers about their practice, and then go and find that in the historical record, you know, that would be a very useful practice. I could get information that I could then show to people who might not have a spirit model, that might be an inside way of getting information and of honoring our dead, crucially. You know, this notion of being respectful of our ancestors rather than, you know, trying to fit them into an agenda of our own.
Well, I've long been a fan of what I, during my own undergrad years, would call necromantic ethnography, and how subjective spiritual experience, maybe it's you know, maybe not absolutely everything that we're experiencing is quote unquote verifiable, but absolutely, yeah. You know, the channels by which we can receive information are broader than we generally believe them to be. And I know that simply from having had experiences that I could not account for, but those experiences themselves were then verified by the historical record.
Exactly.
When I went.
Exactly. And we are in some ways back to that notion of the difficulty of attempting to transmit or receive across time emotional and experiential dimensions of our existence and our interrelation with other people, right? We're back to that notion of emotionology, of the emotionology of initiation and of peak experiences. On a more, you know, on a more commonplace level, I've never met a humanities postgrad researcher who doesn't have at least one story about, I didn't really know what I needed from the library, but I knew I needed something, and this book kind of fell off the shelf and was exactly what I needed. You know, that happens all the time. and there are a variety of ways of you know, working with that and understanding it, from angels of libraries to you know, spirits who are concerned with teaching.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So coming back to emotionality and sort of the broader understanding that you've been bringing to us regarding this idea of the passions and contagion in 17th century England, what were some of the things that were done? Because, you know, if passions were seen as obviously, you know, an aspect of life, but a potentially dangerous, you know, aspect of human life, of the human being, or contagious. What was done to regulate these kinds of passions? What was in place, or what could someone do in regards to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a couple of things. The first is getting a diagnosis, as I've briefly talked about, and that would be, you know, often some form of divination, which would give you a sense of, you could do it in a variety of ways. You could take your nativity chart and look at your proclivities towards particular kinds of emotional experience and expression. You could do what was referred to as a decumberture, which is a kind of chart where you take a snapshot of the heavens at the point someone became ill, or in the case of this more passional work, in the case when they first became, you know, inflamed with passion or became particularly melancholy or sluggishly phlegmatic or what have you. Once you've done that, you could identify the key features that were, you know, the key astrological forces that were at play. You know, if this was, you know, if one found in one's chart, you know, an ill-dignified planet, one could either remedy that with herbs of that planet to strengthen it, or herbs of an opposing planet to balance it out. Equally, one could employ a variety of amulets, of images. And we're back again to this concept of the importance of an image carrying the properties of the thing that it depicts. There are a couple of other features of passion regulation that I think are relevant to practice today. And they were things that might not appear, you know, to some kinds of magical practitioners as especially magical. I'm talking about things like diet, the food that one ate was often prescribed based on your own humoral composition. Now, as we've said, the idea of the humours was that you had a balance, a healthy balance of the humours. But that balance could sometimes take the form of one humour generally being more prevalent than the others. So this was, you know, this is why you could talk about elements of humoral theory having this kind of notion of an early personality typology going on. You could talk about how someone was naturally choleric or naturally phlegmatic. And if someone is naturally choleric, you would say you're probably better off if you're running very hot all the time, you know, not eating a lot of pepper, you know, of making sure that you're drinking, you know, plenty of water. These kinds of ideas are found, you know, across the world to some degree. You know, heat the cold, cool the hot, dry the moist, moisten the dry. You know, these kinds of notions of attending to the imbalances that cause maladies. And these kinds of regimen, these kinds of routines of treatment could be combined in a variety of ways. Another would be the category that was referred to as the heirs. And this was kind of, has been argued by some historians, to represent a kind of notion of environmental health, a notion that, you know, if one is hanging around in areas of, you know, polluted water, that that miasmas would form, and that bad air could be very important in causing not only physical disease, but also emotional dis-ease. And these could be combined in, as I say, in a variety of ways. One of my favorite historians of this, Michael MacDonald, who's done brilliant work on the astrologer-physician Richard Napier that I mentioned briefly, he has this notion of looking at how they were combined that I think is really wonderful. Let's see if I can pull it up here. He talks about basically that things that might look like comfort eating for the miserable actually had deep-seated magical intent behind them. If one is melancholy, if one is suffused with the earthy humor that's cold and dry, one can, you know, sweeten oneself, one can lighten oneself. So he says, here's this quote. Yeah, he says, "The passions are most frequently aroused by personal relationships and social activities, and contemporary writers, that is, writers of that period, devised programs to calm the mentally disordered by rectifying their disturbing working relationships and ill habits. The most famous regimen of this kind required melancholy people to seek merry company, play at honest amusements, dress gaily, and haunt light and lovely places, and to avoid solitude, banish gloomy contemplations, put away dark and disheveled garb, and eschew black and mouldering settings." And in this case, you are literally attempting to bring into your life all that is sweetness and light.
Perfect sense. All of those things are things I would tell someone. Dress daily.
Yeah,
what's wrong with you? And Mary's.
Yep.
Okay. No, this makes so much sense, and I love that. You know, again, coming back to, not that the comparison is full, but just thinking about this idea of coming to balance, and coming to balance as not being an obvious holistic remedy that we see find around the world, and obviously not primitive or ridiculous or silly, but is, you know, obviously a helpful remedy within the realm of a larger, you know, scientific, holistic approach that you're presenting us as the context for how a lot of medicine is seen during this time period. Before we go, so much more that you can say regarding necromancy and the land and those practices in England. What would you, you know, what in those topics sort of interests you the most?
Well, there are a bunch of specific practices that look really interesting. I'm currently also doing some research into how the quote-unquote New World was being depicted by English writers of this time. And what fascinates me in part is that the main things that these early colonialist endeavors are pointing out is that the Native American peoples are interested in venerating their dead. And this idea of the projection of what we deem bad onto the other, this othering process, this alterity, is very interesting to me. One example of it, a simple one, is the notion of voodoo dolls. Now, when Haiti becomes one of the first black, you know, free republic states, news spreads quickly that they practice a bizarre religious magic tradition of voodoo, and instead of learning what that actually involves, various English sources instead decide that if they're practicing black magic, and the pun is clear there, I think. And also with the Latinization of negromancy and necromancy. If they're practicing this evil thing, what does the evil thing look like? Well, let's look at our own history of cursed dolls and poppets, our own shadows onto the other in order to define it, in order to colonize it. And I'm fascinated in what looking at depictions of the ancestor veneration of indigenous peoples looked like to people that thought that was bad, and what it said about their own practices, because there is this rich seam of necromancy in Europe as well. More broadly, I think I'm interested in necromancy as a practice of history itself. Lots of people want to speak for the dead, okay? Whether that's those entrenched in various elites of power structures who want to show that this has always been the way, that this is tradition, this is simply the way things are done, or by various radicals who want to cherry pick examples from history and say, here is our precedent, here is the great example of the dead who would vote for us if they could. And what I'm interested in is letting the dead speak for themselves. I think that's really crucial. I feel often that a responsible historian should vanish, should become invisible, and that hollow bone allows the dead to speak for themselves.
Hence you're being a man after my own heart. The fact that you would liken even, you know, the Lakota concept of the hollow bone to the work and responsibility of the historian. Yeah. I look forward to having an excellent ale with you before the week is out.
Oh, that'd be wonderful.
Before we go, and again, I'm so grateful for your agreeing to be a guest on my show, there is a question that's coming up in the chat room that I think really deserves some attention in the context of European grimoire magic and English ideas of passion and the humors, and how these relate to both the regulation of and remediation of human illness and concerns. Can you talk a bit about the octopus connection?
In that context, I guess so. I have what emerged as an octopus totem it was a reoccurring dream character that I first encountered when I was experimenting with lucid dream. The octopus is a totem that's concerned with shape-shifting, with invisibility, with curiosity. They're the only animals in an aquarium given toys. They're fascinating creatures from magical perspectives as well. As for one instance, an octopus has not one but eight brains in each of its limbs, which culminate in a hub brain, which is donut-shaped to fit around its mouth. And what this means is that if you took a cross-section of an octopus's brain resembles a tiny octopus. And we have this notion then of the reflection of the macrocosm and the microcosm. There are various other reasons why I think octopuses are fascinating. In terms of grimoires and magical practice, there are plenty of spirits in grimoires who are concerned with provoking human passions. There's certainly one in the Grimoireum Verum. And as such, this isn't just about provoking love or making someone afraid of you or raining down terror. It's also about the management of one's own passions and collaborating with these spirits as active processes of getting to know oneself better and hopefully be a more responsible person.
Dude, you could have really just taken the whole octopus thing on the chin, but you went for it and blew my mind.
I have a talk online that I'm happy to put up. I have a talk that I did at a conference called the Kraken Wakes in Bristol, which is on octopus totems and Kraken mythology and those kinds of things, if people are interested.
What is the URL for that?
Oh, it's on the YouTubes, and it's called Eight Arms Are Stirring from the Depths.
Excellent. Eight Arms Are Stirring from the Depths. And you also have a Tumblr page known as Grimoires on Tape. And what do you provide for on that Tumblr page?
Well, there is an archive called Early English Books Online, which provides PDFs and sometimes searchable text forms for a variety of documents from roughly the 15th century to the 19th. And these include a lot of the printed grimoires and other books on things like anything from kitchen physics stuff to occult philosophy to cookery books and things like this. And what I do is I put those PDFs, which are widely available, I put them on there, and I'm sort of curating a space of early modern texts that would be useful for practitioners. So one of the ones that I'm interested in at the moment is a couple of texts, The History of Four-Footed Beasts and The History of Serpents, which are by a guy called Edward Topsell, who was interested in what he calls the enigmatical, the emblematic, the symbolism of animals. And that's especially useful for a variety of magical practices.
Well, thank you so much for that additional work in addition to all the writing that I know that you're constantly doing. We look forward to future musical collaborations, perhaps between you and myself, because, again,
yeah.
I'm just in app that you did with Tomorrow We Sail, and we definitely look forward to you being back on the show, because I know that you are constantly producing work that I'd love for you to be able to share with our listeners. Thank you again so much for joining me here and providing such incredible insight into this time period and into this place on the show. We look forward to having you again.
Well, thank you for having me, Kai. It can sometimes be a very solitary procedure, writing, spending 3-4 years writing a doctorate. So I'm very excited to share it with people, and I'm really very grateful for the opportunity to speak a little bit about it today. And I look forward to more.
I'm thrilled to provide you with any opportunities that I can. I myself am going to do some more research on the very unique octopus. I've got a lot today. This has been an of On Sacred Ground with your host, Kai Armand. Tune in next week as we continue to go deep into the heart of the human experience, in which place plays a primary role. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times. I'll be keeping a light in mine.